Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where the Wisconsin Impact Award covers all tuition costs for qualifying students. More information is at luther.edu/scholarships.
Dietrich Buxtehude, Heinrich Schütz, Heinrich Schmelzer, Johann Hermann Schein. They're not exactly household names today, but in the years before Johann Sebastian Bach, they composed music for the Christmas season, beautiful music, that you may be hearing at Christmas time without knowing who wrote it. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Trevor Stevenson, the founder and artistic director of the Madison Bach Musicians, to take us through a 17th century Christmas, and welcome back to University of the Air.
My pleasure. It's good to be here and for our deep dive into 17th century Germany and their Christmas time.
Is there a way to characterize a whole, let's say, half a century of 17th century music?
Of course, you know, the 17th century is a fascinating time. It was an extremely cold. It's one of the things that they write about now. It was known as the Little Ice Age, and that year after year, the winters were unexpectedly long and cold, which is kind of interesting. It also, of course, in Germany, saw the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648, which was just horrific and was mostly fought on German soil. German armies, but also armies from all over Europe were crisscrossing this, and it's just an amazing amount of destruction going on. Within that, people were writing some of the most beautiful music ever heard. And of course, Christmas is one of their main focus times. So lots of music was required. The Christmas season lasted many weeks, and the 12 days of Christmas and all of that, where they needed music for every occasion. So we have the benefit of it without the 30 Years' War and hearing these masterpieces that were written by composers who many people have never heard of, which is part of the beauty of it, I think.
Some fresh music for the season.
Yeah. And so they loved instrumental music. They loved the human voice. Despite all of the infighting there was about when it was appropriate to sing in church, what language it was appropriate to sing with in church, whether it was right for the organ to accompany the voices or to, God forbid, bring in some strings and things like that, you can't believe the fights they had about this. You know?
Some of them, I guess, having to do with, well, this is not suitable for a religious place.
Mm-hmm.
It's street music.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Popular
it's
songs.
Always that fight. Yeah. And, of course, all the snarky things that were said about the musicians who were hired to do this, right, including the Italians, who were amazing singers and instrumentalists. But they were hired in German churches a lot. And, of course, most of the Italians were Catholics, right? So they were not liked on many fronts, but they really could sing and they really could play. So it's just amazingly interesting. There's I just want to, before I forget, there was a wonderful book written about this called Worship Wars in Early Lutheranism. It's a clever title, by Joseph Herrl, H-E-R-L, and it was Oxford Press in 2004. And it's, you know, it's fairly scholarly and musical, but it is a good window onto the period and how music functioned in the church during that time. So I thought we would start with Heinrich Schütz, who lived to be an incredibly old man, especially for those days, you know, pushing 90, and whose life spans the 30 Years' War. It really falls in the middle of it. Schütz loved Italian music. He went to Italy twice. He studied with Gabrielli on his first trip. And the second time there, he studied with Monteverdi. Schütz was just a very fluid composer. He wrote quickly and with great elegance, and adopting the Italian style to a large extent. And I thought, even though we're doing a Christmas show, I thought we would start with one of his secular masterpieces. This is called a canzonetta. It's for two singers, two violins, and cello and organ. And it's just a lovely song, a love song, about her beautiful hair and how it's so beautiful it is befuddling and turning his world upside down, whoever this narrator is. So we'll start with that. It's a great window onto the 17th century, and then we'll dive into the Christmas music. Thank you.
Stunde.
A work by Heinrich Schütz called Guldenha, your golden hair, how it befuddles me, turns me upside down and twists me up is basically the translation. And that's a secular work from the 17th century. The performance was Madison Bach musicians at their Baroque holiday concert in 2014. I've listened to this recording so many times, but I can never believe Schütz's magic, the way he at the end is able to put that little kind of a sighing tag phrase on. It is convincing every time, you know.
Would these composers that we're going to be hearing during this conversation, all of them have written secular as well as sacred music like Schütz?
Yeah, I think most of them did, right. And I think transportation for them was easy between the two. And of course, it's harder for us to understand it because the religious intensity seems so great, right? And yet when they were ready to party, they were ready to party, and they saw those as not interchangeable, but maybe part of a greater whole. The last composer that we won't hear on this program per se, named Hermann Schein, actually wrote sacred and secular music in equal quantities, and he even wrote his own text for all of his secular pieces. And he said in his preface to his music, "I will compose sacred and secular in equal quantities for my whole career."
He actually said it. Very methodical about that.
And I know. And he was Bach's predecessor at Leipzig by 100 years. And an amazing composer, Hermann Schein.
I'm thinking if you go across the channel to England at the end of the 17th century, Henry Purcell certainly wrote plenty of religious music, but he wrote some very, very secular music too.
and it's secular. It can get raw too.
Yes.
And it's really, really fun. So Schütz, of course, would have picked up most of that bass line and rhythm from the Italians that he studied. But he had such a wonderful way of integrating the Italian sunniness into his Germanic seriousness, which is in much of his religious music. One of the interesting things about Schütz is that he worked at the Dresden court, and as the Thirty Years' War got worse and worse, there were just fewer and fewer musicians to hire. And so he wrote for increasingly smaller forces and started to title his pieces to indicate such as like kleine geistliche music, which, you know, small little church pieces
music,
and spiritual pieces. So, and then after the war, he outlived it for many decades, and then forces got bigger.
Now, we've mentioned that these are composers who predate Bach, although in the case of Dietrich Buxtehude, he certainly overlapped with Bach.
He would have, and because Bach met him. Yeah, that's right. Bach was 20 years old when he traveled to Leipzig. Right, I forgot that. Right, when Bach on foot, they believe this is this far away from central Germany as Bach ever got. Bach went to Lübeck and studied with Buxtehude at the Marienkirche there. And Bach later wrote that he stayed 3 months, even though he wasn't supposed to. He was basically AWOL from his job. He stayed 3 months because Buxtehude's style was so interesting. So it was quite compelling. There was also this wonderful little side story that Buxtehude wanted a successor of the skill of Bach or Handel's level and had kind of offered both of them the job at different times, with the caveat that they marry Buxtehude's daughter, which was something that was done at the time that was part of a succession practice, that you took the job and you also married into the family. And neither Bach nor Handel took him up on it.
Poor Morgana. We don't know what happened to her.
We don't know what happened.
Worth researching.
The Fata Morgana, as it
yeah,
were.
Right. Perhaps some lesser composer.
I think, as in the fate of Morgana.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Who knows what happened? But nevertheless, Buxtehude had an incredible career at this church, and he started a series called the Abendmusik. He actually had picked it up from an earlier person who'd worked there. But it was evening music, and musicians came from all over Germany to participate in it and to listen to it. And also the general public would show up for this and travel great distances. So we're going to hear a Christmas piece by Buxtehude next. This is called The Newborn Baby Jesus. You can hear that very clever use of violins and a string band alternating with a small choral group. We'll hear some of that.
Christmas music from Buxtehude, the newborn child.
It's in the key of A minor, and there's just something about A minor, the way it was tuned and the temperaments of that period, it invokes the snowscape to me. I can't shake the impression, so I'm going to share it.
They probably had it in northern Germany in those early years into the 17th century.
Right, so there's Dietrich Buxtehude. And then we'll move on to Andreas Hammerschmidt next. Hammerschmidt, his nickname was the Orpheus of Zittau, which I always think is the funniest title. He actually came from the Austria and Bohemia area. But when the 30 Years' War early on was getting going, his family, which was a Lutheran family, they had to leave because it was getting so contentious in that area of Bohemia. So he moved into Germany as a young man, was in Freiburg for a while, and then took a long-term job at Zittau. He was a very skilled musician. He wrote quite quickly, quite fluidly, you know, really carried on this great German church music tradition. And the piece we're going to hear next is the Freue dich, du Tochter Zion, which is Rejoice, O You Daughters of Zion, which is a great, I don't know, uplifting type of thing. It really, I mean, it's Christmas music, but it's kind of dance music as well. So I think, you know, maybe they weren't allowed to dance in the aisles, but there was certainly the spirit of the dance was going on here. So, Hammerschmidt, Freue dich, du Tochter Zion.
Christmas music by Andreas Hammerschmidt.
Rejoice, O You Daughters of Zion.
It swings, doesn't it?
It does swing.
It has this kind of lilt to it.
And I want to talk about that kind of rhythmic wormhole that they go through again and again, which is from the triple meter to the duple meter, you know, so where it's a da 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 da, and then suddenly it's da 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 da, and they go back and forth between those two worlds. It's almost like something beneath is always being revealed about it like that. It gives the sense of dimension to the piece. And it was a Renaissance practice that carries over into the Baroque. The other thing that just always present there that I just want to mention is that they're using a figured bass. You know, you've got a bass line, but with the organ or harpsichord chunking along with the chords and the bass line as well. That's a Baroque invention, and that's for this time, early 17th century, that's state of the art. And that's a new thing that was really not done 150 years before that. So beautiful, beautiful writing. And
we should be hearing more from Andreas Hammerschmidt, but perhaps on some future occasion. In the meantime, we will look further and listen further to 17th century Christmas music right after this. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland back with my guest, Trevor Stevenson.
Perhaps the most famous composing music, Michael Schultz.
Right.
Which, in German, Schultz, his father was a minister, and Pretorius in Latin also means magistrate or judge.
So he was just
fair judge.
Yeah, it's and he liked the Latin. They use Latin a lot, so he was just
in Latin a lot.
Yeah, and he liked the Latin name. They use Latin.
We know Pretorius wrote
in Latin a lot, and they all
very intelligent man.
He wrote about music of the period as well, theory, practice,
very intelligent man.
He wrote about music of the period as well, theory, practice,
and most
composed loads of pieces, and we're going to hear
the most famous Christmas piece of that era,
which is Lo, How a Rose,
the most famous
Christmas piece of that era,
which is
Lo, How a Rose, Air Blooming.
Something about the way the tune and the chords work.
It doesn't matter how many times you hear it.
Something about the way the tune and the chords work.
It doesn't matter how many times you hear it.
It's always magic and seems to bring on the season.
Es ist ein Rosenspruch. Irresistible.
Yes, a great tune and a great harmonization. Probably the harmonization is by Pretorius.
And great tune and a great harmonization.
Probably the harmonization is by
Pretorius. Still TBD.
And it's lovely to hear it with the a cappella group.
Sorted it all out.
Voices still TBD.
And it's lovely to hear it with the a cappella group.
And then also with the soloists from among the group.
Is the name
accompanied
of
with the ensemble there.
Flowing
and then also with the soloists from among the group.
Accompanied with the harmonies.
Adding that amazing foundation
background to the super.
So that was Lo, How a Rose,
you know, adding that
blooming,
amazing foundation,
which is, of course,
it.
Mary.
So that was
Mary
Lo, How a Rose,
at Christmas
blooming,
time,
which is, of course,
hearing
Mary
another piece by
Mary
Pretorius here. This is on a hymn that goes back to
Martin
Luther's time.
Another piece by Pretorius here.
And it's called,
this is
Now Comes the Savior
of
the
Nations
or
of the
Heathen.
And it's called
Now Comes the Savior of the Nations or of the Heathen.
It's based on a very unusual melodic line
in German,
which has kind of
It's based on elements a very unusual atonality woven line, into it.
That is, which I mean, has it, kind of
it's the way
elements of atonality woven into it.
But it walks that up is, to the minor I mean, third it, in the it's piece, the way and then drops down to the leading tone without explanation. But it's a very angular type of tune, without explanation. But
it's a very long after this to get some of his most metaphysical
Bach is going to use,
and it's in this tune
long after this to get some of his most metaphysical
Pretorius is setting
and it's in this tune
here. Of this tune
now comes Savior of the Heathen.
A very clever
Pretorius
kind
is setting
of this,
and then
Ritornello big band thing. So they're all
clever.
So you have a small
kind of
group,
verse,
and then
the band comes in
big
with
band
a
thing.
Basically,
so they're alternating.
So you have a small group,
you know,
and then the band comes in,
and then you go back to the small group,
and it goes back and forth,
you know, five or six
high energy thing,
and then you go back to the small group,
and done this
back and forth
effect in his churches,
probably using different areas of the church.
To
one
great
band
effect
another,
in his churches,
so communicating
probably
over long
using
distances
and
giving
the
people
listening
a
completely 3D experience.
That technique was
giving the people listening a completely 3D experience.
And that technique was lifted from the Italians,
and
the
Venetians.
Using the outdoors, surround sound.
It is really
17th century surround sound. And of course, that all gets flattened out in recording.
But in
17th century surround sound,
and of course,
many of these days.
Flattened out in a recording
experience.
So
but in
a
live
a
concert,
of which there are
many these days,
you can
experience it. So we'll hear a little bit of a Pretorius Nun kommt der Heiden Heiland.
Thank you.
that is a Pretorius's amazing arrangement.
Nun komm der Heiden Heiland.
That is Pretorius's amazing arrangement of Nun komm der Heiden Heiland. Now come the savior of the nations.
Flat to sharp relationships going on. Sometimes the flatted note has not even vanished from the room when the sharp note comes in against it.
So it creates a lovely dissonance without a train against it.
So it creates a linear dissonance without a train wreck.
Closely knit. It's lovely. Thank you.
interesting blend of instruments.
Yeah, I was just noticing in that recording how the theorbo,
interesting blend of instruments.
Which is the pluck string.
Yeah, I was just noticing in that recording how
baritone
the
baritone member
theorbo,
of the loop family,
which is
they
the
really
pluck
have
string
the mics
instrument
kind of
close to it, and you can hear that pop
member of the loop
off the low
family.
String. A
they
lot,
really have
yeah.
The mics
set
close to it,
and
you can hear
that
pop off the
banjo in a college education.
Yeah,
but it is hypnotizing.
But it's an amazing sound.
And that's
with
all
college
part of what we call the continuo group.
But it's
harpsichord
often. It's an amazing
an
sound, and that's all part of what we call the continuo group.
The
theorbo
or loop
have harpsichord
would be in there,
often,
playing
the bass line and the chords,
and then
all together.
The theorbo
and you know, often a cello
in there,
or gamba,
playing the bass line and the chords,
creating
all together.
Foundation,
often a cello or a gamba as well.
There's a lot of space between that lower
foundation
and the treble, the violin,
there's a lot of space between that lower part.
It's an Italian
and the
thing and the
treble.
Love it to have
a trumpet,
either a single or a double part on
it's
top,
an Italian,
but with maybe an octave in between
to
have
a sense of
a single or a double part
sound.
On top.
But with
it doesn't mean
in maybe an octave
they didn't have other
give
textures
a sense
where they
would
fill it in
all the way top to bottom.
It doesn't mean in the Baroque era they didn't have other textures where they would fill it in all the way top to bottom. The French were famous for it using five part textures.
But
so
this is more of an Italian
type
of texture.
Now,
from Bieber, and it's
beautiful.
This is more of an Italian
type.
That's a Baroque.
Just
called
heard.
A Baroque trumpet.
Bieber.
It has
and
no
some
vowels.
Beautiful
it's
trumpet
all
playing.
Done
that's
with
again,
overtones.
That's
and
a Baroque
lips.
Called a Baroque trumpet. It has no vowels.
It's
all done with overtones and the lips.
Played so elegantly there.
Monstrously
was,
difficult to play.
And it was played so elegantly.
We are going
there.
To
that was, harmony
immerse ourselves further in a 17th century Christmas.
And
we are going to. This is University
immerse
of ourselves further in a 17th century Christmas.
I'm Norman
Gillilandbeck with my guest, Trevor Stevenson.
This is
University of the Year. We're looking to, listening at a 17th century Christmas in music. We just heard
from
Gillilandbeck with my guest,
that,
Trevor Stevenson.
Dazzling trumpet sonata
from a composer
at
a 17th century Christmas
in two cities.
Music. We just
right.
heard
he was at Graz first, and he
Bieber
left
that,
Graz on a, apparently on a scouting expedition
trumpet
to
sonata
find a new
from
violin
a
from the maker Steiner.
Worked in two
he
cities.
Then got an offer
right.
to
he
job
was at Graz
at
first,
and he left
and he
Graz on a
never got his
on a scouting
Graz,
expedition
ever.
To find a new violin.
Mozart didn't like
Steiner
either.
Yeah, but I'm saying Bieber ended up
staying in Salzburg.
Right, the rest of his career.
He never got his release
with Graz,
from Graz.
He never
ever.
Got the release.
Well,
in those days,
Mozart
you could
like
go
Salzburg
to jail
that
for that.
Either.
It wasn't.
Yeah, yeah, but
wasn't
I'm saying Bieber
thing.
Ended up staying
stay
in Salzburg.
Though.
Right, the rest of his career. And with Graz, he never got the release. And in those days, you could go to jail
right.
for that.
It wasn't a small thing.
It would be a great book about AWOL composers, basically.
And
they decide to take off. Bach actually did stay in house arrest because
it would be a great book about
quitting his Weimar
AWOL
job.
Spent the time composing.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
When they decide to take off, Bach actually did spend a month
may have even
kind of
conceptualized
a
well-tempered
during
thing.
That.
Waste no time when you're
job.
Sorry, spent the time
that's for another century. We'll try to stay on task here in the 17th.
And who is this, Trevor?
We're going to hear Christian Geist
there during that.
Waste no time when you're in prison.
That's for another century. We'll try to stay on task here in the 17th.
And who is this, Trevor?
We're
going to
hear
Christian
Geist,
shepherd
who wrote
Tell What You Have
sorts
Seen.
Of interesting pieces of the church composer.
And
we'll listen to that and then talk
a
little bit about
very
how
much of a Christmas
Geist
piece. This
operated,
is the
what
shepherd's
in his lifetime.
Tell What You Have Seen, Pastoris Dicite.
We'll listen to that and then talk a little bit about how Geist operated, what happened in his lifetime.
Thank you.
Christian Geist. That was Pastores de Chite. Shepherds Tell What You Have Seen. It's absolutely a Christmas piece. Geist was born in 1640 and died Christian Geist. That was he's an organist. De Chite.
I spent a lot of time in Scandinavia.
The only music we have
absolutely
from
a Christmas
him,
piece.
Is from his Scandinavian
Geist was born in 1640
and
died 1711.
He's an organist.
He's a bass singer.
I spent a lot of time in Scandinavia.
And
the only music we have
jobs
from him is from his Scandinavian period.
And he and his wife and three kids all died.
He's a bass singer.
With the plague that just keeps
just
coming
kept
back.
Changing
it's
jobs
it's
a lot.
Through the 17th
so many of them did.
The 18th
right.
century.
And he and his wife
but,
and three kids
a
all
very,
died
very skilled
of the plague.
Musician.
And we're going to hear
that just keeps
in the next
back.
Piece by Geist, just
over
we'll hear
and over
about half of it.
And
this is
based
on one of their favorite Christmas
but,
and Advent
very, very
chorale
skilled
tunes.
Musician.
And we're going to hear
Morgenstern,
which is
next piece
by Geist. Beautifully Shines the Morning Star.
This is
based on one of their favorite Christmas
into the
Advent chorale tunes.
J.S. Bach wrote
the
Morgenstern,
which is
How Beautifully Shines
the
Morning Star,
which, of course, even predates the 17th century.
Well into the 18th
here,
and even 19th Geist century.
Is going to, J.S.
Bach
set of variations.
Of
you can hear the instruments dancing around
tune,
the very
which, of course,
stately and slow-moving tune in the vocal part.
Here,
Geist
and,
is going to, is writing a set of variations. You can hear
kind of
the instruments dancing around
the
very stately and slow-moving tune in the vocal part.
And
just creating a marvelous kind of kaleidoscope of the slow and the quickly moving all in dancing together. So we'll hear a little bit of that. Was Christian Geist's arrangement of Wie schön leuchtet der Morgenstern, How Beautifully Shines the Morning Star, a favorite hymn in the 17th
century. That was Christian
Geist
in the 18th century as well.
We're talking about Geist's name.
His name,
How Beautifully Shines
Geist
the Morning Star,
literally means Christian soul.
A favorite
right, so,
hymn in the 17th century and
to his
in
name.
The 18th century as well.
We're talking about Geist's
it's
name.
A beautiful
his
tune,
name,
Christian Geist, literally means Christian soul.
Faster than that in a service, but of course here it's in a special setting with a highly decorative
you could hear that it's a counterpoint going around,
and it's an unusual
hymn tune. It has
a faster than that
the
in a service,
couple
but
of
course here it's
phrases,
in a special
and
setting
then it has
with
these
highly decorative
phrases in the middle
counterpoint
of it,
going
and
around
then
it.
It's an unusual
ceiling
hymn tune.
It has
one
that
it's worth looking up
and
researching.
Couple of repeated phrases.
You can see why
and
Bach
then it has
was
these
so
pausing
enchanted
phrases
it,
in the middle of it,
and
then
the ceiling element.
It's one that it's worth looking up and
researching.
To Hans Leo Hassler.
You can see why Bach was so enchanted with it.
I believe he's born the same year as Shakespeare, if I got that right. And we're going to move on to Hans Leo Hassler,
which
I'm sure Hassler didn't think of it.
I believe he's born the same year as
Shakespeare,
it was.
He was an accomplished organist.
With
Andre Gabrieli.
I mean, in Venice.
I'm sure Hassler didn't
think of it.
Some of these composers picked up the Italian style, but never leaving Germany.
He was an accomplished organist.
Really did study with Andre Gabrieli in Venice. You know, some of these composers picked up the Italian style
in Augsburg,
but never leaving Germany. And others went down there and really did
another,
study
with the Italian
nexus
directly.
Of all the music we're hearing in this program
is the city of Dresden.
He works in Augsburg.
Almost everyone passes through it
or works a long time there.
Another
was a very
nexus of
city.
All the music we're hearing in this program
it actually had a very established
Dresden.
Catholic
it's
court.
Almost everyone passes through
when,
it or
there,
works
you know,
a long
Catholic
time there.
Were, you know,
it was a very
city
throughout
city.
Germany.
But
it
they
actually had a very established
quite
Catholic
important
court
in the city
at
of
a time when
Hassler
you know,
Catholic
and Lutheran
were
there.
One of the amazing facts about Hassler is that he wrote
music was quite important.
And of course, his original set of words to what becomes
there.
One of the amazing facts about Hassler is that he wrote
St. Matthew Passion,
the tune,
O Sacred
and
Head
of course, his original set of words.
But when Hassler
wrote it,
it
was a secular song
afterward.
And the passion
upshot is
that
Innsbruck,
I left my sacred head now
or Innsbruck, I have to leave you now.
But when Hassler wrote it, it was a secular song,
love song,
and its original
setting. The upshot is the tune was so strong
that J.S.
there or
Innsbruck,
and other Lutherans
commandeered it
and
said, just
we're going to use it for
tear-jerker
love song
so
in its original
it's
setting.
Wonderful how these things
the tune was
moved,
so strong that J.S.
Bach passed through
and,
one
and other Lutherans
and another,
commandeered
it
and said, we're going
so
to use
anyway,
it for Hoster,
religious
you know
ends.
That about him.
So
it's
also wonderful how these things move
his incredible grace of style
at one
moment and
another. Critics said he's the perfect fusion of Italian sweetness
and German seriousness.
Should know that about him.
He also
was just praised for
his incredible grace of style at one
not just
critics said he's the perfect fusion of Italian sweetness
Christmas
and German seriousness.
Piece,
and
you'll hear that in this next
just
piece.
Just watching moves
so Christus
effortlessly
not
between
est,
the duple and the triple
very
meters,
much, you know,
and
it's
keep
it's
the
a
dance
Christmas celebration
on its toes.
Piece and just watch him move so effortlessly between the duple and the triple meters and keep the dance always on its toes.
was Hans Leo Hostler's astoundingly beautiful, I think, Hodie Christus Notus Est, that's Today Christ is Born. And that was Hans Leo Hostler's astoundingly beautiful, I think, Hodie Christus Notus Est, that's Today Christ is Born.
Religious ecstasy.
Beautifully, beautifully performed by the Stile Antico Ride Out
2015
in this music.
So that was our little dip into the 17th century in Germany. And there's only probably 15,000 pieces left to go. So that was our little dip into the 17th century in Germany. And there's only probably 15,000 pieces left to go.
Well, it was a great central end. Our engineer is Lee Rayburn. Again, and we'll be listening to University of the Air on the News Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.